A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on January 12, 1986, entitled, The Heart's Yearning, The Quest for God. The texts for the sermon are Psalm 42, verses 1 and 2, and Matthew 2, verse 2. Copyright, Grand Valley State University.
We live in a secular age, we are told, and I suppose it is true. The secular is life which is organized apart from any reference to God. Oh, people may acknowledge that God exists. Most people do. High majority of people do. But in terms of any practical impact, making any difference about their life, none. Secularism. Maybe the greatest challenge to religion, and specifically to Christian faith, is the kind of apathy, spiritual apathy, that we find in the West. And yet, I suspect that the universality of the phenomena of religion itself is the best testimony to an insatiable yearning in the human heart, a yearning for God. I really believe that. I really believe that in the depths of every human heart there is a longing for God. I think that's probably because we were constituted that way. He created us that way. Augustine felt that. He said, Thou hast made us for thyself, and our hearts are restless till they find their rest in thee. People have funny ways of manifesting that hunger. But I believe that in one fashion or another, that hunger lives in the hearts of all of us. And it results in a quest for God. Strange quest on the part of some of us. Some of us are conventional about it. We come to worship. We open ourselves. We expose ourselves to God. We study the Word. We pray. We study together. Conventionally, we are seekers after God. Others, perhaps out of a kind of spiritual emptiness, become vulnerable to the most bizarre kinds of ideas and practices, following some guru, getting involved in some sect or cult, the strangest, most bizarre activities go on in the name of religion. And some are not consciously seeking God, but perhaps the very numbness with which they live, the kind of depression that paralyzes and immobilizes, is the best evidence that there is an unsatisfied hunger deep within. Some sense the hunger and are afraid of it and plunge into the fast lane and lose themselves in frantic activity in order somehow or other to get rid of the anxiety, the restlessness. Some are conscious, some are unconscious. But I believe that even what might be described as anti-religious or anti-Christian postures and behaviors can be the reverse side of a deep spiritual hunger within. It seems to me that's true. There is a yearning for God, a yearning of the heart that results in all manner of quests for God. And the season of Epiphany tells us that that God whom we seek is the God who has revealed himself. Matthew put his story of the wise men in his gospel because he was writing in the decade of the 80s of the first century to a community that had begun to be largely Jewish Christian, but was becoming more and more infiltrated by Gentiles who were coming to the light. And Matthew was trying to say, it's part of God's program. It's part of his plan. Jesus was intended to be the light of the world. And so already, at the point of his birth Matthew tells us of a star in the sky, a sign in the created order, in nature itself, that shed light into the hearts of those who were diligently seeking after God, who were by that light led to Jesus and to worship. Epiphany is the season in which Matthew tells us Jesus, as the light of the world, began to draw all peoples broadly to himself, and the universality of God's love and grace began to be experienced outside the bounds of the narrow confines of Israel's covenant community. And so we have the story of the star and the wise men, and they have become symbolic for us of that hunger, that questing, that seeking after God, which seems to be a universal human phenomena. God has revealed himself. We've just celebrated Christmas. We've just rejoiced in the truth of the name Emmanuel, God with us. The Word has become flesh. We have had that tangible expression of his love and grace in our history. In the midst of our life, we have rejoiced in the Christmas season, and Epiphany follows hard on Christmas, saying, yes, the Word became flesh that the whole world might know the light. God has revealed himself. Thank God. But he might have made it easier. He might have made it simpler for us. It's not really that simple, is it? Raymond Brown, in his monumental work, The Birth of the Messiah, gives an exhaustive study of the star and the heavenly phenomena and the wise men and all. And he says, a star that would have started in the east and moved over to Jerusalem and turned south to Bethlehem and come to rest, shedding its light on the doorway of a house in which Jesus was born. Such a star, without any notice whatsoever in the records of the time, would seem strange, because such a star would have been the phenomena of the centuries. But there was no general notice of it. I mean, it wasn't like you walked out into the darkness and were struck and blinded by the light, whether your heart was seeking God or not. God could have made it simpler. Haven't you thought on one occasion or another, God, why don't you give me a handle on it? Can't you make it more clear, more simple, more direct? Haven't you wondered why he seems always so obscure in the intuitions of transcendence that come our way? I think within the hearts of all of us there is that desire to know. Friedrich Buechner, in his book Magnificent Defeat, suggests that probably all of us really want to know, and all of us wish that if the God who put the star up there for the wise men is able to do that, why doesn't he rearrange the galaxies so that some night we could walk out into the cold winter darkness and look up into the sky and see the galaxies rearranged to read, yes, I exist, or simply, God is. Buechner says, I'd like to write a story about the reactions of people if that should ever happen. Probably most of us would fall to our knees, some in terror because of guilt, some in terror because of the simplicity of that revelation of the unknown one, whose presence we can always acknowledge but not really bother with. And he says the effect of such a blazing message in the stars would be extraordinary in the immediate wake of it. Wars would cease. Crime would cease. Churches would be overflowing. Why, we'd have to move out into the football stadium and move the National Football League playoffs right off the mat. If God said, I exist, oh, wouldn't we make our move? But then, after a week or a month or a year or more, then what? Buechner says, you know, just the moment that a child looked into the face of his father and said to his father, so he exists, what difference does it make? Just that moment, the music would cease and the stars would fade, and it would be business as usual on planet Earth. Because what we really need, what we think we want, is not what we really need. What we think we want is some scientific verification, some philosophical demonstration. That's what we think we want, what we need. But what we really need is the experience of God. It's not that God is not, it's not that it is not possible to reason of God and to think with our mind about God. It is not that the faith is irrational. Not that we do not have a reasonable faith, but whenever someone starts to talk to me about God and his existence in an intellectual track, I know that we are on a dead-end street. Sometimes it's very interesting. That's where the conversation begins, because the problem's way down here, and it takes courage to get to the problem. Preacher, our questions aren't really intellectual, finally. There's a yearning of the heart. There's a hunger for God. What we really want is the experience of God. And so, just a scientific verification or a philosophical demonstration won't really do it for us in the long run. It would cause a stir, but it wouldn't last. Our hunger is for the experience of God, and it is for that experience that we quest. We know that we are made for something more. Creatures limited by time and space, having to live one moment at a time, having to move through space, and yet having minds and spirits that soar, knowing that there is so much more. He has created eternity in our hearts. We never, never finally rest. There's no human success that can satisfy us. There's no human achievement that can finally put us to rest. We're a restless lot. There's always a stirring within. We are always outreaching our grasp. Because we're hungering for God. Job said, oh, that I knew where I might find him. The psalmist said, why art thou cast down, O my soul? Why art thou disquieted within me? My heart longs for the living God as the deer pants for living springs of water. He could have made it more easy. He could have made it more simple. Wouldn't it be nice some night to step out and see it written in the stars? And yet he has revealed himself. Could it be that we are looking in the wrong places? Could it be that we have not eyes to see or ears to hear that which is everywhere around us? If Christmas is true, and if the message of Epiphany is true, then he has revealed himself and he is available to us. You have perhaps read the story on occasion, a rather old, famous story of the other wise men. Legend tells us there were three wise men. The Bible doesn't say there were three. We don't know how many there were, but if there were three, then the other one would be the fourth. And Henry Van Dyke, a preacher of note, wrote at about the turn of the century, the story of the other wise men, which he said was given to him in a dream as a gift. And he simply wrote it down. About the other wise men who lived in Persia, who saw the rising of the star in the east, as did the other three, who agreed with them to follow the star. But first of all, invited his own friends in his own area to come, telling them of the vision of the star, of the king that was born in the house of the Hebrews, inviting them to come on pilgrimage to find the king of the Jews. All of them began to make excuse, and none of them would accompany him. And so he made his way all alone to the appointed place where he was to meet the other three, from whence they would make their way across the desert to Judea. He rode like fury through all days and nights until finally he was almost there, when the horse stopped in the darkness of night, and he saw in front of the horse lying on the road the figure of a man. He dismounted to find that the man was almost dead. Thinking he was dead, he was about to leave when there was a sigh. And then he found himself in a dilemma. Should he follow the quest of his heart, seeking after God, or should he wait and stay by this one who happened to be a Hebrew merchant, trying to bring him back to health and to life, and thereby perhaps missing his chance to find his God? He stayed and he helped and he revived until the person could carry on by his own, on his own. And then he continued his way to the appointed rendezvous, but the other three had gone before him. They left him a note saying, "Follow us across the desert." But his horse was spent and his money was gone. He had three jewels with him, three precious jewels that he would bring to the king. So he made his way back to Babylon and he restocked his supplies and made provision and got himself a camel and started off on his own across the desert to follow the star to find the king of the Jews. And he got to Bethlehem and his heart rejoiced, and he inquired whether or not his friends, the visitors from the east, had come, and the word was yes, they had come. But there was no sign of them, and he walked down the streets of Bethlehem, and from a little cottage came the voice of a woman who was singing to her child, and he entered and he inquired further about whether or not she had seen his friends. And she said, "Yes, they came and they brought gifts, but they are gone." And he said, "What's happening in the village?" And she said, "There's a spirit of evil around. Something is happening. We know not what." And then there was the sound of troops in the street and the lament of women weeping and crying. And the woman grasped her child to her and cowered in the corner, while the other wise man went to the door to see the captain of the Roman troops approaching the door, gruffly asking admittance that he might search the house. And the other wise man reached into his breast and took out the second jewel, the ruby, and handed it to the captain and said, "This is for the one who will move on. There is no child in this place." And the captain greedily took the gem and moved his troops on, and the child was saved. And the wise men now knew that two of his gems for the king had been used because he had sought to meet the need, the human need that was before him. But still he continued the quest, and he found himself in Egypt and traversed the ancient world looking for signs of the king of the Jews, but never finding him. Until 33 years later, as a very old man, he came one more time to Jerusalem. And there he saw a tumult in the city and a multitude moving out the gate. And he asked what was going on. And they said, "We're going to Golgotha, for there will be a crucifixion today. They are crucifying the king of the Jews." And his heart leapt within him, for he thought, "Now I have left one precious jewel, one pearl of great price. By it, perhaps, in this my dying day, I am able to find my king and ransom him and save him from disaster." And just as he was making his way with the multitude, some soldiers came with a young woman, dragging her by the hair through the street. She broke loose and threw herself at his feet and saw that he was from Persia. And she said, "I too am from Persia, and I too worship the God of purity. Redeem me, save me. My father died, and they've captured me to pay off his debts." And the other wise man, having left one gem for his king, yet having at his feet this obvious human need, struggled once more, took the gem, offered it to the soldiers, ransomed the young lady, and it became dark as midnight, and the earth trembled with an earthquake, and a brick loosened above him and fell and hit him in the temple, and he fell to the ground, and she thought him dead. And as she hovered over him, she heard music and words which she could not make out. But she heard him respond, gasping as he was dying, "Not so, Lord. When did I see you hungry? When did I see you naked? Or when were you in prison that I visited you?" And she heard the sounds once again, beautiful, sublime music and words that she could not make out, but had she been able to translate them and figure them out, they would have been the words of Jesus saying, "Verily I say unto you, inasmuch as you have done it unto one of the least of these, my brethren, you have done it unto me." And throughout all of his pilgrimage, he had found none to worship, but multitudes to help. He had fed the hungry and clothed the naked and redeemed the prisoner. And as he was dying, there was solemnity on his face, the peace that passes understanding. For he who thought that he had quested all his life and missed his king had, through the very human service that he had offered and the love that he had given, found the king in every person he had met. God has revealed himself, but maybe we're not looking. Maybe we're not listening. If you feel comfortable where you are right now, will you take the hand of the person next to you, on your right, on your left? Just take hands all across the sanctuary this morning. There is a yearning in the human heart for God. Maybe we're looking in the wrong place. Maybe we're trying to find him where he cannot be found. God is found in the flesh that you are holding, in the eyes of a loved one, in the face of a stranger, in the presence of human need. There God is found. And if we live in faith and walk in love, God dwells in us.